I'm here with Alexander McCurse, editor-in-chief of The Durand. Alexander, let's follow up on the U.S.-China trade talks, trade war, what's happening between Trump and Xi after the G20 Osaka summit. This is the first video that we're actually doing after the G20 took place in Japan. And Alexander, to be honest, I think you called this one correctly. My gut feeling after reading all the various news topics that came out, all the stories that came out, different stories related to the U.S. and China, but I think they're all connected. My gut feeling is that we are looking at an economic and political divorce between the United States and China. And dare I say, I think it may be an amicable divorce. In other words, not so turbulent of a separation. Though a separation it will be. We have a lot of stories coming out related to the U.S. and China. We have the U.S. selling arms to Taiwan. That pissed off the Chinese. We have the Huawei incident where they are going to be launching their new OS in August. They also gave results for the year, which weren't so bad. I mean, Huawei did pretty steady considering, you know, everything that happened this year to them. We have China's buying a lot of gold, and we have Trump kind of lamenting that, you know, the Chinese are not holding up their end of the bargain by buying U.S. agricultural products, at least not as of yet, as they agreed during the G20. So, Alexander, give us a wrap-up as to how you see things after the meeting in Japan, and just break it down for us.
I think that, again, you summarized it correctly. I think that the United States and China are heading towards an economic and political divorce. I think that they both understand that it has to be done in a structured and orderly way. And I think that there are intelligent people running this thing on both sides. And I think they're able to do that. The other thing is that at the absolute top of the two governments, Donald Trump and Xi Jinping get on with each other and are able to discuss things like they were able to discuss, for example, Huawei without apparently having a shouting match, and were even able to come to an agreement. Now, contrast this with the chaotic and utterly dysfunctional way in which the British have conducted the EU. The Brexit negotiations with the EU, constantly seeking maximum advantage and aiming basically to pressure Britain into some sort of a vassal state situation. And large sections of the British elite falling for that, actually supporting the EU as it tries to pursue that agenda, and with no sign of any kind of agreement, even for a civilized divorce taking place. Here, on the contrary, as between China and the US, you have two self-confident superpowers, because both countries are economic superpowers. They're able to talk to each other with a great deal of respect and understanding. There is obviously a lot of conflict. You're right to mention Taiwan, which is, the US arms sales to Taiwan are obviously a red line for China. But at the same time, despite all these tensions, despite all these disagreements, despite the fact that there is now an acceptance and a recognition on both sides that their relationship is going to become increasingly adversarial, and that they must therefore, by definition, disengage economically and politically from each other, they both understand that it is in their mutual interest to go about doing it in a civilized and structured way. And that's what we saw happening at the G20 summit in Osaka. Trump and Xi came together. They agreed to a resumption of the trade talks, but nobody really now, I think, expects that those trade talks are going to end in a comprehensive economic agreement. But what they will do is that they will allow each side time to adjust and to prepare for the divorce which is to come. In the meantime, Donald Trump makes a minor concession on Huawei. I think a lot of people were saying that this was going to be a dramatic retreat by Trump on Huawei and that he'd capitulated to Xi Jinping in some ways. I was always skeptical about that. A minor retreat from Huawei on Huawei, which will allow US companies that have invested a lot in their commercial relationship with Huawei to gradually ease off that. The Chinese, in turn, are gradually shifting away from buying US agricultural exports, but it's going to happen in a way which I think will slowly insulate US farmers. It will happen in a gradual way so that the US can look after its farmers as that happens. And at the end of this road, we're going to see China and the United States existing in different economic and financial and internet universes. And I want to talk about the financial thing in a moment, because I think now we're beginning to see the contours of how that's going to work.
All right, we'll tackle the financial part. Tackle that part right now.
I think the interesting thing is, as I said, a couple of years ago, the country that began to move out of the dollar in a big way and which was selling its US treasuries and buying gold was Russia. Now China has joined in and they've been doing this in earnest. And increasingly, more and more countries around China and Russia, countries that are sort of crystallizing around this Eurasian bloc, seem to be following the lead of these two powers. What I think this is working towards, and I think this is now only a matter of time, is a situation where the Chinese and the Russians launch what will in effect be a gold-backed currency for mutual trade between themselves, mediated by some sort of integrated banking institution, rather like the IMF was originally designed to be at Bretton Woods in 1944. It evolved into something completely different, but we will be seeing a structured integration of the Eurasian economies led by China and Russia with a single financial trading system, which will be backed by gold.
That's massive news.
Absolutely.
If it really does move in that direction, it's massive news. And China holds a boatload of treasuries, U.S. treasuries and U.S. debt.
Does.
A boatload. Are they dumping those treasuries slowly and in turn not, moving to gold?
This is the point. They're not dumping their U.S. treasuries in the way that, say, Russia dumped its treasuries. I mean, Russia basically sold off most of its treasuries last year. It's still got some, but it's not got anywhere near as many as it once did. China is doing it in a steady and gradual way. So where China used to be the country that was buying US treasuries on an enormous scale at the height of the Chinese US economic and trading relationship in the mid-2000s, now, as that economic and trading relationship has soured, the Chinese, in anticipation, as I said, of this coming divorce, are gradually, but in a structured way, selling off their treasuries and are now also buying gold.
Okay, so what do you make of Trump's comments about China not fulfilling their obligation as far as purchasing U.S. agricultural products? Do you think there's merit in Trump's statement? Do you think that China is doing this deliberately? What do you make of that part of the Osaka G20 deal?
To the extent that I think that what Trump said is true, I think what Trump doesn't acknowledge is that from the Chinese point of view, they agreed to step up agricultural imports from the US in return for the US commitment that they thought they'd obtained to actually allow Huawei to provide some technological services to the US government at a lower grade level. Now, it seems that may not happen to the extent that the Chinese thought that it would. And for that reason, I think the Chinese have stepped back from some of the promises that they'd made in return by buying less agricultural goods. But I think we, you know, looking beyond this immediate question, the reality is that just as the Chinese are going to, you know, accepting that this commercial divorce from the US is happening, they are already now looking to buy their food increasingly from other parties. And I'm hearing reports about Chinese food import companies now fanning across Russia to find out what products Russia can provide China. And Russia can provide lots of food products to China. And the Chinese also taking an increasing interest, again, in importing soybeans from Brazil. So I think that even if we look beyond this particular spat, the simple reality is, though, I think that the Chinese will do it again fairly gradually. They will continue to reduce their food imports from the US as part of this divorce that I say is coming.
What about the technology side of things outside of Huawei? Because we've focused a lot on what's going on within this one company, Huawei, but you have the companies like Apple and other technologies, a lot of technology companies and a lot of companies in general in the United States that rely on Chinese manufacturing. What's going to happen there? I mean, do you think they're going to, I mean, let's take Apple, which is probably the most famous case.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, is Apple going to realistically start to move its manufacturing outside of China and look for alternative sources?
When I say a divorce, I don't mean to suggest that there will be a total rupture of trade. I don't think we're looking at a situation like what we used to see between East and West, the Soviet bloc and the Western powers in the Cold War, when there was actually very little trade going on at all. Some trade will continue. Quite a lot of trade will continue. And US companies, probably like Apple, are now so deeply enmeshed in China that I think it's inconceivable that they will want to pull out entirely, if only because China now is a very big market for them. So Apple will remain in China. Huawei, in some form, I suspect, will remain in the US. What I think we're not going to see to the extent that we did is this interchange of technologies that did happen with the US shifting some of its most advanced, US companies shifting some of their most advanced production to China, sourcing some of their most advanced materials. I mean, I can remember Steve Jobs saying that he bought the sort of glass panels that you get on iPads, like this one, for example. He found that he could source those much more efficiently in China than he could in the US. And that's why he stuck to China rather than the US. I think the days of that happening are coming to an end. But I think that the Chinese, the companies that make those sort of products in China, will be providing them to Chinese producers. And I think the US has plenty of other options to source that technology elsewhere.
Can you make the counter argument, however, that if China is moving towards some sort of gold standard along with Russia, or at least trading in gold with Russia, I would imagine that other countries are going to also want in on the action. Quite a lot of countries, I imagine, are going to want on the action. Isn't this, if not a direct threat against the U.S. dollar and the dollar hegemony that has, you know, persisted for God knows how many decades, wouldn't you categorize that as even more severe than what we saw between, say, the U.S. and the USSR during the Cold War? I mean, because you're going after the heart of U.S. empire, are you not?
Absolutely. I mean, this is going to be a massive challenge going down, looking, you know, into the not so distant future to the US. A far more powerful challenge than the one the old Soviet Union represented. The Soviet Union was a military competitor of the United States. It was an ideological competitor of the United States. It was never an economic competitor because it was not part of the international world trading system. The Soviet Union was not part. It did not have a convertible currency. It did not trade. It deliberately chose not to trade in the way that China does. And of course, it ran its economy in a fundamentally different and completely different way, so that it and its satellite states in Eastern Europe and elsewhere were tightly integrated into a planned system. What we're looking at with China and Russia is not that kind of system at all. It is what we're looking at is an actual trading system, similar in some respects to the one the United States set up in the Western world after the Second World War, but created in rivalry to that of the United States and possessing what are ultimately larger resources. Because, of course, China and Russia together, plus the other Eurasian powers, potentially have greater resources than the United States and Europe potentially do. What I would say is that I think that we are some distance away from the point where that challenge to the US from this bloc will become existential. And I think that what the Russians and the Chinese will want to do is that, yes, they will have more and more countries wanting to trade with them through this gold-based system that I'm talking about. But because it will be a very tightly regulated gold-based system, rather like the Bretton Woods system that existed in the West in the 1950s, I think that the Russians and the Chinese will, to a certain extent, in fact, to a great extent, want to keep some members outside this club. In other words, I don't think they will want everybody to join. They will want countries that are in reasonable shape, that have reasonably strong gold reserves of their own, that are prepared to observe the rules of this particular club, and which are have economies which are compatible with it. But in time, I mean, it will pose an existential challenge. And I think people in the United States understand that and recognize that. What I don't think they are prepared to do at the moment is adjust to that reality, that this is what is going to come. And I mean, at some point they will need to, and they will need to accept that economic hegemony, like everything else, is not forever in one country, and that eventually the focus and center of gravity of the world economic system will shift elsewhere, but that the United States will remain a mighty economy with a huge concentration of economic wealth and power. It won't, as I said, necessarily mean the end of the United States, but it will mean the end of the United States at the center of the world economy and the world political system.
And finally, Alexander, do you think that Trump is kind of, his strategy is to keep these negotiations kind of floating along, kind of in limbo? That's the way it seems right now. It's kind of, you know, just in a state of limbo, day after day, month after month, just keep it there until the elections, get through the elections, and then kind of maybe accelerate this economic and political divorce, or at least, push it into a different gear.
I think that's exactly what Trump's plan is. And by the way, I think that's exactly Xi Jinping's plan also. Right. I think both leaders, as I said, have basically come to an understanding with each other that they will pursue their divorce, but that they will pursue it gradually. Neither wants to see massive disruption and damage done to their respective economies. Both understand that they need time to adjust. Donald Trump has the concern of an election he needs to win next year. And of course, Xi Jinping always has to look at the political situation in China, of which he may be the leader, but contrary to what some people say, he's not in a position to disregard what Chinese people think. China doesn't work like that at all. It's not an autocracy anymore. So, as I said, both leaders, for both political and economic reasons, have come to this understanding. And that is definitely their agenda, to pursue this divorce gradually, keep these negotiations ticking along until the point comes, probably after the 2020 election, when each of them is ready to accelerate it and take it faster and further.
Okay, Alexander Mercurius, Editor-in-Chief of The Duran, thank you very much. Guys, if you like this video, click on the subscribe button down below. Click on the notifications bell to make sure you get notifications every time we push out a new video. Remember to share this channel. You can share it on Twitter, you can share it on Facebook, but more importantly, you can share it on Minds and on Gab, and you can also find us on BitChute as well. You can also get an audio copy of this video, so follow us on iTunes and on SoundCloud. And don't forget, you can also find us on Instagram, theduran_com. You can also donate to us on PayPal, Patreon, and Subscribestar, so please help us out by donating to us. The links are in the description box down below. And you can always help us out by purchasing really top-notch quality magic mugs, which really are magic.
Indeed.
Well, they improve your geopolitical quotient by...
Oh, many, many orders of magnitude.
Orders of magnitude.
If I may say. As a matter of fact, can I say, by the way, we're getting wonderful feedback on these products. I had a comment from one of our viewers in which he said that he'd also tried the experiment, which I have, of drinking beer from one of these mugs and found that it actually worked excellently. I think, in fact, he used this mug to do it. This is Catherine's mug, which is the one with the double-headed eagle of Moscow and St. George on his white horse slaying the dragon of fake news and untruth, just as we do in the Duran. Now, this is obviously, as I said, my wife's mug. I don't think she's actually drunk beer from this, but I know she's drunk hot chocolate from it. And it's what we drink breakfast. We have our breakfast coffee from these mugs. Now, as I said, I have drunk beer from my mug, and it's excellent for drinking beer from it. But mainly I drink tea. The tea I'm drinking at the moment is a nice green tea. It's a Longjin tea made from the city of Huangzhou. How appropriate, given, as I said, that we're talking about China on this program. Huangzhou, just to say, is, of course, the capital, was the capital of China, which was visited by Marco Polo. It had just been captured by Kublai Khan and the Mongols. But he was absolutely astonished by what he saw there. And he appreciated its tea, which was already famous at that time. But of course, he didn't have a magnificent mug like this to drink it from. What a shame for Marco Polo. What good luck for us. As you can see, this mug has the Duran logo, which you can also see on my magnificent polo shirt with a double-headed eagle, which looks both to the east and the west. As we've done on this program, we've discussed the United States and China, the two countries of East and West, the two superpowers. And we've done it with equal knowledge and erudition. And how else could you do it if you didn't get the kind of refreshment that these magnificent mugs provide? And by the way, the Chinese, who are the inventors of porcelain, would certainly appreciate this beautiful porcelain body, which is really marvelous to hold. And marvelous to see. It's got this extraordinary luster. So buy yourself a mug like this. Buy yourself a wonderful polo shirt like this. Now, today, again, I was at a social event this afternoon. I was wearing this polo shirt, getting lots of admiring glances. And why wouldn't I? It's got marvelous color. It's 100% cotton. It's a 100% stylish, elegant, handsome shirt, beautifully stitched and beautifully cut, fits me marvelously, looks wonderful on me. My wife loves me on it. I got lots of admiring glances, as I said, at the social event. And as you said, as I said before, it's got our own logo, our Durand logo, the double-headed eagle, beautifully embroidered in gold. So do yourself the benefit. Buy one of our shirts. Buy some of our mugs. You can get lots of other mugs, by the way. We're doing a series now. We've got one which I'm getting shortly, with the Alpha, the badge of the Alpha Force. That's Russia's special services unit, the equivalent of the US Delta Force. And we've also got one with the Russian state double-headed eagle. This is not this one, which is ours, or the Moscow one, which is this one. It's the one that Putin himself has on his mugs. And of course, he was there whilst Putin and Trump were talking together at Osaka with his mug with a double-headed eagle on it. So you can get one of these marvelous mugs. You can get one of these wonderful shirts. You can find all sorts of other nice things in our shop. Why don't you go there? Help the Durand. Help yourself. Buy one of these wonderful things and support us. And get our thanks for your support, and support yourself too.
Okay, Alexander Metcurse, Editor-in-Chief of the Durand, thank you very much. Until next time, everybody, take care.